Hello and welcome to Heartland Security Radio, where we recognize that the one true security is in the land of the heart. This is your host, Steve Behrman, and this is Swami Biyandananda. And together we welcome you to an entertaining and enlightening hour as part of the World Puja Network. Well, you know, Western culture has bet the house on mental structures, reductionist science, and a Newtonian worldview based on opposing forces and dueling dualities. However, more and more of us are coming to recognize that in doing that, civilization has left out at least half of reality, if not more, and this has led to a decidedly half-witted approach to confronting the real challenges to our species right now. So, how do we reintegrate shamanic wisdom and the reality that exists beyond words to gain a fuller grasp of human life and human potential? And what do the ancient prophecies tell us about the upcoming 2012 gateway? How do we cultivate a new media to grow our new understandings? Today's guest will help us explore a new reality that just might be more real than the one we think we're in. Comments, Swami? Yes, it's true. Thanks to a mind-contracting mass media, far too many Americans suffer from irony deficiency. The media has inundated us with so much toxic BS that our skeptic system is overflowed, and we end up swallowing huge ironies whole. Now, when people spend too much time absorbed in mainstream media, well, these thought particles get caught between the ears, leaving a residue that can lead to truth decay. And that is why the American Transcendental Association recommends using mental floss after every exposure to TV news to prevent truth decay and malconclusion, okay? Well, good advice, Swami. Today's guest on this week's show is Daniel Pinchbeck. He is the author of 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, and he's the author of Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism. Daniel has written for many publications, including Esquire, New York Times Magazine, The Village Voice, Rolling Stone. He lives in New York's East Village, where he is editorial director of Reality Sandwich, and he's the co-producer of Evolver.net. He's also host of the upcoming documentary 2012, Time for Change. Welcome, Daniel.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. So let's just jump right in and begin at the beginning. How did you become interested in breaking open the head to expand the mind?
I was in my, late 20s, and I was been working in New York as a magazine editor and journalist, and I've been writing for the New York Times Magazine and Esquire, and I just began to get more and more depressed, went through an existential crisis, I'd grown up in a kind of secular materialist context, and sort of recognized that underlying that was a nihilistic approach to the world, people were just invested only in their particular lives with a kind of burnout mentality about the future. And, I noted this particularly because I got interested in ecological subjects and wanted to explore them deeper, for the media, and began to realize how profoundly, important they were and how much danger we'd created by our, industrial culture. And I basically couldn't find hooks that would work for these magazines. They seemed to be only interested in superficial subjects, celebrities, distractions. And this kind of just deepened my sense of unhappiness around the culture. And it just seemed like, it was kind of an empty, distraction-seeking culture. And so then I'd grown up as a secular materialist, I began to interrogate for myself how I actually, did I actually know for a fact that, there weren't other dimensions of being or other dimensions of consciousness, or that the soul didn't have some type of existence beyond the physical body. And when I began to think about that stuff, I remembered my psychedelic experiences back in college, which had seemed to be kind of clues indicating that there might be, kind of a larger story that was being denied to us. So, since I had the journalistic tools, I decided I would explore that in more depth as an adult. So I began to get magazine assignments and took ayahuasca, which is a psychedelic drink from the Amazon rainforest, in a ceremony for the Village Voice. Got an assignment from a magazine ultimately to go to West Africa and undergo a tribal initiation ritual in Gabon with a tribe called the Bwiti, using a substance known as Iboga, which in the West has also become known as Ibogaine. I also then went down to Ecuador, visited a tribe called the Sequoia, who use ayahuasca in their sacred culture, and visited the Mazatec Indians in Mexico and Oaxaca, which is where the Western world rediscovered psilocybin magic mushrooms in the 1950s, and studied kind of the whole history of the modern West and its relationship to shamanism and the psychedelic experience. And I ended up, having a series of experiences that really did change my worldview. And through the course of writing the first book, Breaking Open the Head, I kind of shifted from secular materialism to recognizing and kind of incorporating these other dimensions of psychic experience and psychic capacity. And just had a lot of types of experiences that confirmed what you read about in occult literature and alchemical literature and in shamanism tales. And so that was kind of the path.
Well, you really empowered yourself in a genuine work-study program, earn while you learn, and getting to do articles to be the observer and the participant at the same time. And, when you were talking, I just got the sense that what you're talking about is post-postmodernism. That there's something else beyond that, the existential, nihilistic, nothing really matters, and you did break open your own head. So in the process of doing that and making these discoveries, in terms of your own life, I mean, obviously your work changed because you were being an observer and writer about your own experiences. In terms of your relationship with people, with the world, et cetera, what happened? What changed?
All sorts of things changed. It was, there's if you look at the sort of underlying paradigm of shamanism, that Joseph Campbell talks about, the sort of process of kind of separation and initiation and return. I kind of separated from the community that I'd been part of and the value system that community represented, and then went through this initiatory quest and then sort of came back to share it with people. And it meant that a lot of people who'd been, kind of part of my world previously were kind of very cynical and alienated and kind of, ridiculed what I was doing and these experiences. And ultimately, I had to distance myself from a lot of those people. So over time, it led me to kind of finding my way to a different community. And it's been interesting. It's been powerful journey, but also in some ways a bittersweet one. I mean, I'm still, I just went to a sort of typical like large New York kind of media digital technology party over the weekend. And I was talking to people there, and most of the people that I speak with really haven't yet made this type of shift or interrogation of their own belief system, and so they're mainly still operating out of this sense of kind of emptiness and futility, even though that they don't necessarily recognize that, and it makes me feel very kind of sad to see that. And also kind of concerned, because I think that without that underlying change in paradigm, we're not going to be able to make a shift as a global community into a different type of behavior pattern.
Yeah, and I think what it also involves, obviously I know that gap that you're talking about, because there's perfectly wonderful, very, very, very talented people, who... have this belief system that we all grew up in, whether we knew it or not, it was a dominant belief system, and that really is the materialism, money, matter, and so on. And you've actually walked between two worlds. You've had the experience of, you know, these initiations, you know, the very, very small percentage of Western people have had. You've sought them out. And so you're now, you know, you're kind of a bridge. So, you know, question, which I'm sure you're in, how does one build a bridge between outside the matrix world that you've seen and experienced and bring that back to the lives that, that people have? And you know, how do you reach across and create a bridge?
Well, I mean, I would say on many different levels, that's kind of my life's work right now. And I would say that there's like different answers for different types of people. I mean, everybody has different skills. You know, I mean, I think there are musicians who go across, you know, into those other realities and then transduce that information, you know, as music. Mm-hmm. You know, so somebody else may, you know, change the direction of their career, you know, as a whatever, as a lawyer or whatever. But, you know, for me as a writer, I mean, that was really like the primary or initial tool was trying to, you know, understand for myself, integrate the experiences and then convey them through language. And, you know, from that, that's also led to, you know, some of the work that I'm doing now with starting this company, Evolver, and, you know, trying to figure out how you kind of make use of this new paradigm, you know, in a time of intense transformation. You know, what does it kind of point towards for the individual and for society? And then how do you help, you know, build that bridge into a different form of society, maybe?
You know, that's an interesting thing as the bit of a paradox. And being somebody, a person of words, and we were recently at the Science and Non-Duality Conference, and there was a lot of conversation about how you, you know, how do you communicate that effing ineffable? You know, how do you make the bridge between the beyond words to words? And tell me more about that, how your work has been influenced, you know, that coming back as a writer from those dimensions.
Let's see, what can I say about that? I think that, you know, psychedelic experiences, you do encounter aspects of them which are completely beyond, you know, language. And sometimes you have experiences where, you know, you're just, you know, I would just recognize, okay, there's nothing I'm going to be able to pull back, you know, about this experience. But then I think that there are, you know, other aspects of the experience that you can retrieve, you know, and form into language. And, you know, and I think in a way, unless we can create, you know, conceptual containers, you know, and kind of language, you know, out of our experiences, they remain, you know, inaccessible. So for me, that act of languaging stuff is very formative creative in itself. I mean, I look at something like Terence McKenna, you know, who was this psychedelic philosopher of the 70s and through the 90s, and he wrote about these kind of his vision of his DMT, dimethyltryptamine or DMT experiences, where he would see what he described as, you know, hyper-transforming machine elves. And the way he, you know, characterized it linguistically, I think then actually became kind of common property, and it became kind of a filter or a lens through which a lot of people then, you know, interpreted that experience. You know, which doesn't necessarily mean that's the experience in and of itself, but, you know, we do need conceptual containers to shape, you know, our perceptions.
I think, and just knowing something is possible. You
what's
know,
that?
Knowing that reality, that people have had that experience, creates openness to having it and recognizing it when you see it.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that, you know, the role of the artist in our society, you know, is akin, you know, in some respects to the realm of the shaman, in which, you know, you should go into these unknown spaces and then, you know, use, you know, language or visual art or music or poetry to kind of retrieve elements of what's beyond, you know, has been beyond conception, and then give it a concept and a form so that then other people have a map for their experiences.
Well, you know, popular culture in terms of music and certainly film has given us, you know, I mean, Joseph Campbell would probably say that those constitute they hold the myths of, you know, both our the civilization that we have and also the emerging civilization as well. So the songs are like mantras, and the, you know, the films are like you know, heroes' journeys and so on that we can identify with and relate to. Before we talk, I want to definitely get into your, you know, the media work that you're doing now. I want to talk a little bit about your book about 2012, and everybody seems to be talking about 2012, and even Swami's writing a book called 2012: The Secrets Revealed, and it's going to be out in 2013. So definitely, everybody's thinking about it. What was 2012 to you, and you know, what did you bring out of that experience with that book?
After I wrote the first book, as I said, I'd kind of shifted into accepting that, you know, the kind of shamanic paradigm had validity to it, and as part of that, I began to kind of be kind of careful around synchronicities, you know, because in shamanic cultures, synchronicities are seen as kind of potentially guideposts. You know, when you have experiences that seem to reveal like a bridge between the psychic and the physical, they may indicate, you know, kind of paths to explore. And I had a number of you know, what seemed to me very potent synchronicities around 2012 that I discuss in the book. And, you know, I just felt kind of called upon to investigate and explore, you know, and it kind of arose naturally out of the first book because, you know, 2012, one of the first popularizers was, you know, Terence McKenna, mm-hmm. who had been in the Amazon when he was in his early 20s and had what he said was like a week-long conversation with you know, the sort of mycelial intelligence expressed through the psilocybin molecule, in which a huge amount of information had been downloaded to him about the psilocybin, you know, the mushrooms maybe representing a kind of galactic intelligence that disseminated itself across the universe as spores, and that we were moving towards as a species a transformation in our, you know, perception, our realization of space and time, that this was actually happening, you know, in the fairly near future. And so that led him to look at the nature of time in relationship to this whole mathematical kind of system that he devised using the I Ching. And he ended up, you know, before he even knew about the Mayan calendar and the end of the 5,125-year long count on December 21st, 2012, of kind of placing the end of this form of time around that at near that point. So I definitely was fascinated by his ideas, although I didn't find that his time wave really, you know, makes perfect sense in that it's an attempt to kind of systematize what he talks about as the ingression of novelty into history. And I don't really see how you can make novelty into something that's, you know, kind of a point on a graph, because it's something that's so kind of subjective. I mean, you know, what is a tremendous novel, a tremendous, you know, new event, you know. So, however, he inspired me, and then I began to study José Arguelles's work. José Arguelles was one of the people who, you know, developed the harmonic convergence in 1987 and wrote a number of, I think, really fascinating books around the Mayan calendar, and in some ways related it to the I Ching, that there's a kind of some kind of mathematical kind of deep mathematical structure that the 260 day count of the Dzogchen and the I Ching are both kind of reflections of, And he put this together in a kind of beautiful form in this book, Earth Ascending. And then he developed in the Mayan factor this sense that time is a kind of fractal that repeats on different scales, and you can actually look at these patterns of how episodes of creativity and kind of consciousness development kind of unfold, and that we're approaching the you know, once again, the kind of culmination of a cycle of history that could then lead to a shift into a different realization of consciousness and a transformation of society. And then also, if you step back, from these projections and just look at what's happening in the world right now, it's very obvious that our civilization is radically unsustainable, and is beginning to kind of manifest, early signs of an incipient meltdown. As you discussed, well in your book, Spontaneous Evolution. We have created a kind of capitalist system that depends upon infinite product and infinite wealth on a small and finite world. And at the moment, we've kind of hit peak oil, peak water, peak minerals, and so on. So the thrust of this civilization towards ever increasing production is hitting the hard limits on the reality of what the planet can offer, and at that point, we either are going to make a really substantive shift in how we're conducting ourselves, or we literally may not survive as a species, and it does seem quite plausible that the crux of that. Decision time, the window that we have to make a shift is really in this period. I'm not sure about 2012 exactly, but we have a narrow decision window to somehow make a transformation on a species level.
Well, I like that term, radically unsustainable, because that's really what it is. It seems to be that all of the dysfunction is rapidly multiplying to the point where at this level of organization, the center can't hold. And so, the fact that you're calling your organizing, on the ground organizing, spaces, places, contexts, you're calling them spores. I'd like to look at the relationship between where we are now, and in our book, the metaphor that we use, and often metaphors are way more than metaphors, they're actually organizing principles, is the caterpillar to butterfly. And we see see all around us the attempts, if you look at the attempt of fixing the healthcare system or fixing the banking system and so on, we're seeing that you can't patch up the caterpillar, and that the old is falling away, whether we like it or not, and you can see people clinging to the wreckage, and the new is being born. So let's talk a little bit about the relationship between this emerging reality, which may emerge on December 21st, 2012, or that may be just a metaphorical locus for a big change taking place. I want to explore it in a couple of different ways. I want to learn more about time and the change in time, what they call the end of time. And Swami, of course, says we're running out of time, but there's a new supply coming any minute. How would this changed world be changed? How would we experience it differently in this new time?
Gosh, that's a great question. I mean, my book 2012 came out in 2006, and I did go into that in depth in the book. It's sort of not what I've actually been thinking about lately, so I have to kind of check my memory storage unit to see if I can improve it. I looked at it through the philosophy of a guy named Gene Gebser. Who wrote a book called The Ever-Present Origin. And Gebser was a German philosopher who looked at the evolution of consciousness, kind of in a very Germanic way in terms of these different structures. So he looked at this, that we've gone through a number of structures of consciousness that are different ways of realizing and embodying kind of space-time. And the first was the archaic, which kind of could be correlated to the aboriginal understanding. And, aboriginal really means of the origin. And as I mentioned, his book is The Ever-Present Origin.
Mm-hmm.
So the aboriginal perspective is, there never was a fall. There really isn't progress. And their ceremonial culture is devised to, kind of maintain a connection with these dreamtime ancestors and continue the kind of manifestation of the sacred reality, in which we participate, in every moment. And then there was a kind of magical or tribal consciousness. Then, traditional, mythical structure of consciousness. If you look at cultures like the Egyptian or the classical Maya, even they have a cyclical, essentially a cyclical model of time. Or the Hindu, so with these different yuga cycles, we're now in the Kali Yuga. According to the Egyptians, they followed the processional cycle, this vast 26,000 year cycle, going through the zodiac, and the Maya had these long counts and so on. So there was a cyclical model of time where there was a kind of return, as you went forward. And then we developed this mental rational structure where we kind of projected ourselves into a linear time, a spatialized time. In a sense, we became possessed by space and matter in a way that, previous cultures hadn't been. And you can see that in the shift into perspective where you had, hieratic expressions of people on these flat surfaces. Suddenly humans were fully projected into this three-dimensional space, and we began to see everything in terms of space and matter. So we came to think of time in terms of space and matter. So when we think about all of our metaphors that we use when we talk about time, we talk about, as you said, running out of time, wasting time, spending time. We're constantly thinking about time as a quantity, of which we can, have enough or not enough. And actually our whole machine culture, the whole industrial culture is built to kind of overwhelm time, to outspeed this time that we can never get enough of. So Gebser recognized that this mental rational consciousness structure was reaching its limit and was beginning to break apart. And he saw that reflected in modern art, cubism, experimental fiction, experimental music. And so he proposed that the next kind of iteration of human consciousness would be what he called the integral structure. And as part of that, and of course it's hard to predict something when you're looking at an experience that may be kind of like a quantum jump, in our capacity to know and exist and so on. But he would see part of it as a realization that all these forms of time exist simultaneously, that they're kind of like different veils that you can place over the subject. So, at this moment as we're speaking, we're both at the ever-present origin, the archaic or the aboriginal sacred moment that never ends. We're also in the cyclical time of the mythological civilizations, and we're in this progressive, linear, modern time. If we recognize all these different types of time kind of folding upon each other, then we arrive in a different perspective.
Well, it sounds like what you're pointing at, although pointing is very linear too, where we may be emerging to in this realization is an understanding, as exactly as you said, that all of these times exist at the same time. All of these exist right now, and we learn to use the linear time the way it's been, as a tool rather than a ruler.
Yeah.
And even the term ruler is is pretty straight. Yeah, I really like that. I want to kind of, if we can take the highlighter and highlight that underneath, that the possessed by space and matter, that imagining, and of course the whole paradigm of scientific materialism has to do with that's all there is.
Right.
After, you know, when the matter turns to dust, that's the end of it. That's it. That's the end of it. And so all of these times exist at the same time.
Right.
So that's really that might be one of the better amplifications of what this understanding means. You're being in terms of that shaman that you mentioned earlier who separates from the tribe, takes the initiation, and returns with values, valuable wisdom, insights, practical applications. In these two media domains that you've been involved with, Evolver.net and Reality Sandwich, obviously those are attempts to proliferate this new understanding or the beginnings of a new understanding. So say more about that, and also how this mycelial network that you've talked about, how that relates to the spores that you're developing as part of Evolver.
Sure. I mean, it's gone through different levels of development. I mean, there was actually, I was involved in a first attempt to start Evolver a couple of years ago with a company in LA that kind of shorted out. On one level, when I published my books, I mean, I even had a discussion forum with Breaking Open the Head. I found, that I began to get so much incredible correspondence from people who, had similar experiences than I and similar ideas and resonances. But it became clear there wasn't really a cultural media forum where people could express these ideas, at the depth and the level of sophistication that they needed to. I mean, you have kind of like New Age publications, but they generally, are not somehow deep enough, in various ways. So, that led me to want to start a media outlet, and we started realitysandwich.com a couple of years ago, and really we were a sort of astonished by the amount of material that began to come our way. We thought we would publish a couple times a week. We soon had enough material to publish like new essays every day, and it just seemed that we'd struck this chord that people responded to. So that's been going for 2 years now. We have about 90,000 readers a month, I would say, at this point. Hmm. And, while we developed that project, I mean, I'd always wanted to do, with this first company anyway, this Evolver social network. I think we're seeing, how transformative these kind of social media and social technologies of the Internet could be. But for the most part, they're mostly kind of standard corporate models where they're trying to, make money off of people in traditional ways and sell to them, advertise to them and stuff like that. I'm really fascinated by what type of deeper transformation the social media could be pointing towards. And I think if you look at the history of media forums, whenever there's a profound new transformative form of media, it usually leads to deep changes in society and deep changes in the political system. So you couldn't have had, empires until you had written codes of law. You couldn't have had the modern democratic, nation state until you had printing presses so that you could disseminate news and at least educate people enough to be able to vote. So I think we might be on the cusp of that kind of transition, through the Internet and this type of social technology. So the idea was to create a network so that all the people who are, beginning to open up to this new paradigm of understanding can find each other and begin to develop local communities, hopefully when that develops to a certain extent, we'll go into the next phase of whatever this is. What I like about the concept of Evolver is that, it is just an evolution, so we're just continuing to develop along with the interests of the community. I mean, I'm very interested in ultimately providing tools like alternative platforms for people to exchange goods and services and value, you know, as was discussed at that Economics of Peace conference we were at in Sonoma. You know, I'm interested in finding those companies that are making the products that really will serve people in a rapid process of transformation and helping, you know, those companies get their stuff to people, such as like aquaponics kits that you can grow food in dense urban environments and so on. You know, alternative health products that protect people from some of the, you know, negative effects of our post-industrial culture. So, you know, we're still kind of in the early stages. You know, we've been hampered by a lack of capitalization. You know, you generally, you know, if you're trying to do something really transformative, it's extremely difficult to convince people who have made their wealth in the old paradigm that they should support it. You know, they often maybe feel threatened by it. But, you know, we're seeing over time, you know, different individuals who have means kind of going through their own transformation process and then finding us and contributing to the work that we're doing. But it's definitely, you know, it's definitely been a complicated process. We're soon launching a new version of Reality Sandwich that will include a subscription service. We've started to do a series of teleseminars. We're also working on a video platform. I'd like to do, you know, television both for Reality Sandwich and Evolver. And, you know, yeah, I think that would be a great next step. We, you know, the through the magazine, we're developing young writers, and then we can potentially get them book deals, help them kind of shape their career, help them to have platforms, you know, for themselves.
Well, that sounds really, again, and as it's evolving, you know, this is a affiliative and non-hierarchical system, and we have been so trained, even if we don't want to, we've been so trained in these hierarchical systems, and, you know, here we are in a, you know, you're talking about social networks and very rapidly sharing information, and then there's all of these issues about ownership of information, and, you know, that the rules are changing all the time, and, you know, that the systems are obviously evolving. But the ways of, you know, creating ways to support, you know, through affiliations and so on, to support some of these businesses that are actually bringing the real value that we need, that's very, very important. Now, tell us more about these spores that have, I think, are helping to link the global ideas with local communities.
Yeah, I mean, so we've kind of launched regular offline meetups, you know, and we're kind of trying to find the juncture between, you know, us providing, you know, a structure and a scaffold so that people can self-organize. Because I think you find that a lot of people, you know, it's hard for them to start something by themselves, but if there's kind of already kind of a logo and an entity and some kind of ethos, then, you know, if they get inspired by that, they can, like, plug in and use their talents for that. So at the moment, I think we have about 30 different spores, maybe 25 in the U.S. or five or more outside the U.S. and South Africa and Europe and so on. And we're doing monthly events. We come up with a theme in conjunction with all the regional organizers. And then, you know, if it's alternative health in a theme 1 month, then in the local areas, people find, you know, alternative health practitioners or lecturers and bring them in and give them a time to present their project. We're doing one, I don't know when your show's going to air, but this week we're doing a spore on the subject of 2012 itself as a kind of counter-propaganda to the Hollywood film that's coming out.
Yeah, very important to offer a different perspective to the, we call them disasteroid scenarios, that those kinds of things present. So you're finding that that people are essentially in all of these different locations, they are working with the same theme, obviously in different ways that localize it. And then is there a feedback system into the global community in order to, so people know what happened in all these little places?
Yeah. I mean, we've got all that, you know, on the Evolver network, evolver.net. We have our regionals, where each regional group, like, you know, kind of discusses what they're doing and what happened. And, you know, obviously we're using, like, other tools like, you know, Facebook and so on. And, you know, in some of the areas, they're very small, you know, maybe a handful of people or a couple dozen or something. In other areas, they've gotten quite big. I mean, I went to Atlanta over the summer. They had an Evolver Fest where it was maybe 300 people or more at this kind of permaculture-based community farm. And that was really, really super, you know, inspiring to see that. Certainly, you know, would be a big jump from where we are now to something that really could become, you know, as just transformative as we like it to be. But, you know, then I think part of it is also learning how to work with different groups. I mean, one group that was really kind of a model for us was Transition Town.
Yes.
You know, so they're raising awareness and also kind of getting local communities to organize around, you know, peak oil and climate change, particularly. You know, we look at, you know, stuff like that and you know, think it will, you know, also help raise consciousness around it. But the what we're adding to that is also this kind of consciousness element, you know, this kind of spiritual and shamanic component, which we feel, you know, is as tangibly an aspect of the transformation that has to take place as simply looking at the, you know, material aspects.
Well, you used the term earlier, you used the term an integral. And it seems that at this time, all of these things that have operated as separate domains have to awaken to recognize that it's all part of the same matrix, that you cannot have an economy or even you can't even have an ecological economy without contact with this spiritual, one would call it spiritual, extra-human dimension, you know, beyond our lives. And I see that there's, you know, there's some bumps in the awakening of people who've been focused primarily in making the material world a better place, coming up against some of these spiritual ideas, which they may relate to, on one hand, the religion that they went running from or their parents went running from, or on the other hand, some kind of somewhat threatening outside the matrix shamanic mumbo-jumbo.
Well, yeah, there's that, but then on the other side of it, there's a lot of people who've been bought part of this kind of personal culture, personal transformation culture, who are similarly struggling, you know, with you know the you know the possibility that maybe that also isn't enough, you know, that you know that you may have aligned your, you know, inner frequencies, but actually you know that effort has to be connected with a kind of social and political struggle.
Exactly. I find that that's happened, you know, because what I've been doing for the past, you know, 20 or so years has been, you know, the Swami whole performance and so on has started in the so-called New Age, New Thought community. And there's been some tremendous transformations over there as, you know, people used to say, well, politics, we don't go there. And now they're going, politics has already come here. So it, you know, so we have to deal with it, and again, you know, all of the people who've been working to make their lives better, you know, we're now at a point where we're beginning to recognize that it's more than just the individual human. You know, our species survival is now at stake, and we have to start learning to think and feel as a species, and you know that requires bumping us out of what you called earlier that. You know, addiction to this time, this very linear time-space trance. So this is, you know, I think you're really on the, you know, I think we come up with a better term, Bruce Lipton and I, instead of New Age, we're calling it New Edge.
I came up with that term years ago, too, or I heard about it from somebody else. That term's been bouncing around for a while.
Yeah, I know it has. I've seen, you know, I've seen this New Edge thing, and we just kind of revived it.
Yeah.
But that's really what it is, because there is an edge, there is a leading edge, and the dance is to, you know, now that you've come back from many of these shamanic, these experiences, now you're the bridge builder.
Yeah, well, I mean, we really have like very significant problems to deal with, and we actually still really do not have the kind of social infrastructure in place even to make a dent in them. I mean, something like Monsanto, you know, really needs to be just stopped. You know, the idea that you can, you know, have these experiments in life and in seed happening without a precautionary principle, without the involvement of civil society. I mean, you know, we really should have hundreds of thousands of people protesting, doing nonviolent demonstration, whatever it takes to stop these inhuman monstrosities. You know, and same with the military-industrial complex. You know, we really, I think, unfortunately, the culture has been incredibly effective at distracting people, alienating them from their own souls, making them really feel that they don't care, that they have no investment in the future. And now we're really in deep shit because I've looked at things about the kind of weapons that the military-industrial complex is developing, use of depleted uranium in these foreign conflicts, permanently irradiating people's lands, just really like a decimation. And unless there's some kind of rising up of the human spirit, I really don't think that we're gonna succeed or continue on this planet. And while I'd like to say that I see that happening, I can't really say that I see that happening at this point. I see little glimmers of it, but mostly it seems that people are still kind of narcotized and entranced and kind of fragmented. That's kind
well,
of
well, that's an interesting. That's an interesting. We're coming to the end of our conversation, but that's an interesting jumping off point for one more question, and that is, as an individual, how do you manage that great contradiction that on one hand your life work is really toward awakening and enabling, helping others to awaken, and yet you see that not only is the inertia formidable. I mean, all of the institutions, all of the dysfunctional institutions have, they've got the weight. They've got the weight with them. They're sitting on so many of these new possibilities. How do you manage to hold these two things simultaneously, that things look bad, but I'm doing this anyway?
By the way, maybe we should have another conversation at some point, because there's a lot of stuff we haven't really covered yet. In my book 2012, I described a lot of synchro-mystical type experiences. In fact, I had one recently in relationship to you and your work. I studied the crop circles and discussed them in my last book. I found that there was this huge crop circle in Holland of this person inside of a butterfly. Somebody sent me this kind of pop New Age video that showed the cover of your book. I mean, I'd already, delved into Bruce Lipton's work a little bit, but that made me, immediately run off and get the book and devour it. But that's just one tiny example. I mean, I've had a lot of confirmations that, there is a, deeper energy, or a kind of transformative force of consciousness that is shepherding this kind of global process. And I feel like when one can be in alignment with that force, somehow it's moving in the right direction. Doesn't necessarily, mean that the outcome that I would like to see will happen, but I feel that I get enough confirmation that I'm staying on the right track.
Well, I really appreciate that perspective, Daniel Pinchbeck. Where can people tell us again your two websites that people can track your work now?
Well, there's realitysandwich.com, which is the web magazine where we publish essays every day of the week and news items and so on. And you can subscribe to the newsletter and so on. Then there's evolver.net, which is our social network, which is not the prettiest or most advanced piece of technology, but I still think it's useful. People can create a profile there. They can also join these regional groups, Evolver Spores, or they can create one of them, you know, for themselves, and we'll help you to do that if they want to bring this idea to their local community.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation, Daniel Pinchbeck, and we'll be back with one last word from the Swami after these messages.
Hi, this is Steve Behrman. You know, I experienced Tiziana Della Rovere's Adorata work, and I can tell you, it's an important missing piece, not only P-I-E-C-E, but P-E-A-C-E, because it helps us access and use our own internal masculine and feminine resources so that we're fully empowered both to dream our dream and to physically manifest it. Adorata provides you with practical tools to integrate these principles in your personal life to bring fulfillment to your relationships, satisfaction to your work, expression to your creative potential, and the presence of the divine as love intimately felt. To find out more about the work, please go to adorata.org. That's adorata.org. This is Swami Pyandananda talking about money. Have you recently had a near-debt experience? Are you suffering from deficit inattention disorder or cash flow deficiency? Then the following message might be for you. Hi, this is Steve Behrman with great news for folks living in the U.S. and Canada. It's about a solution to a serious challenge that millions of people face today, the terrible burden of debt. Now you can eliminate debt, all debt, mortgages, car loans, credit cards, student loans, all debt, in a fraction of the time it would normally take. And you can do it without coming up with even $1 more than you already spent. This award-winning program uses software that becomes your personal financial GPS to leverage every dollar you spend to either earn interest or cancel interest and eliminate debt. A 30-year mortgage, for example, will typically pay off in 8 to 11 years, other debt even faster. Sound too good to be true? Well, it's true and it's good. Want to find out more? Go to mergeandflow.com, that's MergeandFlow.com, to see how much money you can save and how soon you can be out of debt. You have nothing to lose but your debt. That's mergeandflow, MergeandFlow.com.
Thanks again, Daniel Pinchbeck. Daniel's work can be found online at realitysandwich.com and evolver.net. Any final words, Swami?
Well, I think it's all been said, and I love this idea of spores, and I am going to engage in some spore radical activity myself.
Okay, thanks for the perspective, Swami. Thank you again, Daniel. You know what, Swami? I think we're out of time.
Well, but I hear a new supply will be arriving any minute now.
Okay, till next week then. This is Steve Behrman and Swami Pyandananda saying goodbye, and may the force be with you. Namaste and namasko.
G-U-R-U, 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 G-U-R-U.